All right, pronouncers, special episode today. Steven is presenting. He's presenting his growth story. We're going to dive in pretty deep, doubling the business last year. So there's going to be a lot of tidbits here that we're going to get into. Super excited. But first, we've got four incredible sponsors. You guys know the list. They've been with us since day one. So we appreciate them too. First up, Easy Way. Spending hours cleaning screens is a thing of the past with Easy Way's screen printing and screen cleaning chemicals. Their innovative formulas are designed to work quickly and effectively, so you can spend less time cleaning and more time creating. Plus, EasyWay is passionate about empowering printers of all skill levels. As you guys know, they work with hundreds of distributors all over, and they're your partner. They're there to help with the how-tos and best practices. They've got great resources and expert advice to be able to help you succeed in screen printing.
Bruce, have you heard of Multicraft underscore daddy? If you go to your Instagram right now and you follow Multicraft underscore daddy, you can get ink supplies or daddy. Multicraft screen printing and digital supplies for over 50 years has been providing you with top brands at competitive prices. Mention the Printavo pod and get an additional 10% off your order. Dave's actually partnered up with PMI tape. They're giving away a free case of PMI tape for every episode to one lucky listener. You just have to DM and follow Dave and he'll pick one a week. Thanks so much, PMI Tape and Multicraft.
His latest post, by the way, I don't know if you saw it on Instagram, is actually pretty funny. When you find the perfect white ink, it's this guy just leaning over a bucket of paint who just white paint everywhere all over him. Supercolor. Supercolor is the world's best heat transfer made for screen printers by screen printers. They understand the pressures and expectations of running a screen printing business. That's why they pride themselves on being super fast and super easy. In fact, Supercolor just released Super DTF, so you guys can order their minimums before were 10 sheets, and now you can get down to one. And it's quick. The ship is very quick. Not only that, they have an incredible support team. They're there to be able to help with issues, things that come up. Again, they're another partner in your business. Make sure to mention Printavo15. That'll get you 15% off your order.
All right, Graphic Source. We just added another team member to our team. So I think we're up to six, five. If you need a solution to improve efficiency and reduce costs in your art department, Graphic Source is there for you. They offer industry-leading outsource options by truly becoming a part of your team. They plug and play directly with Printavo and other shop management softwares. So when it comes to steps, mockups, digitizing, creative art, order management, back office, admin, customer service, there's no better company in the game to work with. They have over 30 years in the game and they understand shops' needs and have a proven track record of success. Hit them up, graphicsource.com. Let them know you heard it on the pod. Get 50% off your vector, SEP, or embroidery order with discount code PRINTAVOPOD24. All right.
So just as a little preface, Steven, you texted. We've got this list with a ton of different ideas of things to talk about. We haven't just had a guy's episode, you know, just boys hanging out, talking smack, and what's going on. But you said you guys doubled the business last year, which is an incredible feat. And you shared the numbers. I won't spoil that because you can get into that. And I was like, man, that sounds like a great episode. Why don't, like, can we go really deep and I'll just uncomfortably poke deeper?
As you do.
So I don't know. Well, I guess I'll turn it over and let you, I don't know where you want to start.
So I would first start by saying what we're doing at Campus Inc. is not for the typical print shop. This is what we're doing is don't try this at home, folks. We've received a lot of outside investment. We're pouring millions of dollars into this. I have competitors that probably listen to this. I'll see shops try to start similar ones that are cute. What we're doing is pretty intense, and I brought in investors to help me out. But the fundamentals of what we're doing and what I've learned along the way to grow, I think there's a lot of really good learnings and best practices and some of the routes that we've taken in the business to do. I'd be happy to share. So I'll start off by saying, you know, Campus Inc. was able to double in a year, go from $5 million to $10 million. And our trajectory is to do that again in a year. So I'd just like to kind of dig through it, I guess. I don't know, Bruce, where do you want to start?
You know, when I hear that, I think of the team scaling pain, because it's like first reaction is, damn, that's amazing. Holy cow. Congratulations. And then it's like, wait a second. Those are two pretty separate businesses, like at those different scales.
Yeah. And here's the thing. When I, you know, when I talk to my friends in the industry, most people don't want that. Jeffrey Paul said it best. He said, you know, I made the most amount of my money when I ran three autos. Right. And so I think hopefully listeners can say, if I want to grow, this is what I'm going to need to do. But I don't think everyone listening to this is saying, like, hey, I want to go to the moon and take my company to $100 million. I think it's important to recognize what you want first before you start to grow. How did you think of growth, Bruce, when you were thinking Printavo? Was it steady growth? Would you want exponential growth, hyper growth? Tell us about that.
We wanted as much growth as possible while still being profitable to break even. So now I made some calculations that were, we were in the red, but those were like, okay, you know, here's 4 months, 5 months. I know what we're doing. We're wanted to hire this person. We'll use that. We'll scale back in and then we'll be in the green again. But it wasn't nearly as calculated as what you've done. And I've seen some of the budgeting and forecasting, and obviously you have a CFO, and I mean, you're almost, it's almost like there's train tracks laid down and now you're building the train on top of it to run as quickly as you can on it. Right.
Right. I think you said something there is you want to grow profitably, right? In the type of growth that we do at Campus Inc. with venture backed growth, we actually have to burn, when you guys hear like, hey, we raised an investment, we actually have to spend it pretty quickly and deploy it. And the goal is by the time that money's run out, you need to be profitable and you need to, you know, start breaking even, right? And so if you're thinking about growth in your business, most shops listening to this are bootstrapped, meaning they haven't taken much outside funding. And so that means they can really only invest in growth what they make. And so I think the first principle of this is that real growth costs money. And if you are going to grow your business as the owner, you still have a cost associated to you, right? I feel like sometimes shop owners don't value the cost that they have to grow the company, like your salary, your time, your livelihood, those kind of things. But real growth costs money. And I want to make sure that people understand real growth is different than just natural growth. Bruce, what do you see in our, do you see, when I say that, what does that make you think? Real growth versus natural growth.
Yeah, I kind of am curious on why the 10, what, like why 10 million? And was that the goal of it to then back into the cost to be able to get there?
I think for us, we knew that if we were going to, we saw the end goal and we're like, we have to climb to that to be able to afford what we want to do, to be able to have the engineers and the CTOs and to be able to do everything. The business could not operate at $5, $6, $7 million. Like that was almost a, we had to get to that next milestone to be able to get to profitability and get to steady state and those kind of things. So it's almost like an ultimatum that we set for ourselves and giving ourselves a certain time horizon.
When you thought about that, did you break it down? Obviously, there's seasonality, there's you know, the spend aspects, but did you break it down into a budget? Because I remember, you know, when I was starting to go through budgeting, I figured, wow, we need to be a little bit more proactive in hiring, or we need to like actually understand the different areas of spend that we have and create budgets for different departments. Did you break that down into almost monthly goals or quarterly goals? And I know you run Traction. So do these two things correlate? Because I'm trying to understand that the pathway to like, all right, we kick off the year, it's 2023, it's January. By March, we need to be at X so that we can plan for the hiring and the marketing spend and all this other stuff.
Yeah, so now it's daily. I mean, every morning we know exactly how much we have to sell every single day on every single one of our channels to hit our goals. So I think the first point is real growth costs money. Natural growth will happen, word of mouth. Your business should probably grow at least the inflation rate or how the economy's doing, you know, things 4, 5, 6%, 10%, that'll happen. But if you want to really step on it, there's going to be a cost associated to it. Now, to understand that cost, the first thing that we did at Campus Inc. was we hired a CFO. And I basically was like, look, if we're going to try to light this thing up, I have to know down to the penny and nickel how this is going to work, because you could essentially blow up in the atmosphere. And so to your point, Bruce, we brought Steve Watson in. And, you know, I kind of like splurged. I was like, I have to know my numbers. I can't wait till the end of the month and then figure out like, oh, did I grow or not? Or maybe I want to do this next month. Like, no, we have to calculate everything. And so I think the first element to growth is almost overpaying for really good financials, if you will, right? Like,
oh, for like modeling.
Yeah. Right. And so, I hear shops saying like, I don't like my accountant, or I don't like my CFO, I don't like, you know, this or that. It's like, pay a premium, because if you get the right one, you'll never look back and they'll pay themselves off. Right. Like, Bruce, you kind of said that.
What is a premium? I'm assuming a CFO is 100 to 200K ish a year. Is there a stepping? Cause that's a lot, right? So is there, and that makes sense at a stage. Is there a, have you tried a fractional, or do you like, yeah, what do those run?
So we went from, we kind of started with the traditional business bookkeeper, right? And we went to a profit first, couple thousand dollars a month. Then when we raised money from Mark Cuban, I got a fractional CFO. So that was like a pretty intense accounting company. And so did you know that accounting is everything in the past, finance is future?
You know, I learned this about a year ago.
Wild.
I thought we were just throwing around words.
Yeah. And so Watts is like, no, finance is future state, accounting's past state. And I was like, oh.
Yeah, yeah.
Huh. Okay. So right. A fractional CFO.
And EBITDA is what again?
And so anyways, so we overpay like, you know, $3,000-$4,000 a month, $40,000-$50,000 a year. But like, it's almost like doing a crazy audit on the business and them really, 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 really getting in and you kind of like having premium service. And so when we brought in Mark's money, that was the first thing that we're like, okay, if we're going to bring in outside capital, we have to just get the best of the best. And to your point, you know, so we went from a couple thousand dollars a month to $4,000 a month to a full-time CFO, to now he has an entire team that do different things: accounts receivable, accounts payable, taxes, licensing, payroll, you name it. But we grew, you know, as the business grew, I also grew that department and spend, because it's like the most important part of everything. I feel like shops are cheap with it. I don't know. What do you hear?
Well, can you, well, first of all, did you like the accounting firm enough to share their name or no?
If you want to message me personally, I will send you them. How about that?
Okay. And then what was the, how many hours was someone like that spending at, you know, the couple thousand dollars a month range?
Look, I think
3 hours a week, or?
A junior level bookkeeping firm is going to charge $150 an hour or something like that. So you're going to get 8 to 10 hours, maybe 15 hours a month, something like that.
But was there responsibilities creating that projection and doing the accounting work, or what did you have them focus on at that stage? Maybe that's the question. Stage one, the couple thousand a month. Stage two, you said 4,000 to 5,000 a month. And then stage three, full time. How did the responsibilities change?
So I think accuracy and things that are more in real time. Right. And so a traditional bookkeeper, you finish the month, you give them their books, you give them your books, they clean them up for you, and they give you something back 3 weeks later. So if if it's January, you don't find out until February 20th how you did in January. So you're already almost through through February. So basic bookkeeping is retroactively cleaning up your numbers and telling you what you did.
That was stage one.
That was stage one. Stage two is starting to look at future state. So they still have to do all that stuff. They're going to intensify the amount of tracking that they're doing. So switching from cash accounting to accrual accounting, right? Tracking journal entries throughout the month instead of at the end of the month. So like intensifying the accounting and then looking at your cash flow analysis and figuring out how much money you have in the bank, how much you're spending actively on new ideas and new things, and can you afford, are you keeping up with everything that you're doing, right? Because just because we got this big amount of money from investors meant that, you know, I can't just go crazy. It was like giving a kid a super soaker and saying, go spend money. Everything, we still had to calculate it out and figure out like, you know, okay, we're going to hire this employee this month. That's going to add $60,000 a year, right? And so that mid-level accounting firm, I basically got them to their max. And then when we went out and we got another investment and then the company really started to cook, that's when I was like, we have to bring this in-house. So that was a huge, I wish I would have done that way earlier.
The stage three, the full-time or the
stage two?
Stage two. Interesting.
Stage two.
I was thinking is that most folks are in stage one, but it seems there's so much more value in stage two. But when do you think that kicks in? Is that $1 million a year in sales? $500,000 in sales? $3 million?
No, I think you can use a basic bookkeeper to get you, you know, once you start having over like 20 to 25 employees and getting over like $2.5 to $3 million.
That's where stage two is important.
Yeah, that's probably where you really want to beef up your accounting practices and your finance practices, as we talk about, right? Once like Watson was in there, I can model things out. And so in order to grow your business, you have to create a model. You have to know what the input-output machine is, right? And so, you know, obviously for all of us, it's selling shirts. But like, what's the how? Right? And how do you put your business into what we call like a little black box so that you know when you feed it money or you feed it something, something will come out of the other side. Like sales will come out of the other side. Right? And so kind of like as I was doing this, I was really trying to define my model because once you have that model, you can replicate it. And so a really good instance is like Kyle Dennis, Five Boys Apparel. All right? Five Boys?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they have a $3.99 deal, 100 shirts, $3.99. You know, they know exactly what a customer is worth to them, and they know exactly how long a customer lasts, and they know exactly how much profit they get out of an entire customer experience. That's why they're so aggressive to get new customers. And so it's really, really important to create a model that's profitable, that you can look at and say, you know, this is what a customer is worth to me. We knew that for every, you know, school that we launched, it could be anywhere between $50,000 and $1 million. So we at least knew a range. And so we're like, okay, we at least have a range, and we would start to put them on the wall and say, okay, big schools could be worth this. Small schools could be worth this. We're going to need this many athletes at this school. Right. And so we started almost like play Catan and like chart out what the addressable market would look like. Bruce, go back to Printavo. Did you look at your customer value, how much a customer was worth to you, how long they would stay with you, those kind of things?
Software being a little bit different in that I think it's easier to be analytical about with the recurring revenue business model. But yes, so there's a metric called lifetime value, as you mentioned, and then there's a metric called cost to acquire customer, CAC. And essentially, there's like a ratio. So it's LTV, lifetime value divided by CAC, is some sort of ratio, and it should be between like 3, it could be to 5 or so. And then essentially what that means is that you can spend, let's say the ratio is 5, that means that you're not spending enough to acquire more customers. So if it costs about an average of $200 to acquire a customer, then in your marketing spend for the month divided by the total number of customers you brought in, that's that average CAC value. You know, if you're at $100, you're essentially leaving money on the table because you're not spending enough on finding different channels and different avenues to bring people in. Now, we did want to keep that lifetime value to CAC ratio within like 3 to 5, though, because that felt good and that customer would be a profitable one over X period of time, whatever that is. You know, maybe it's a 3-month period or a 5-month period. But yeah, that's how the analytics worked for us on the marketing front, and we still use that.
So CAC, customer acquisition cost, is essentially your entire sales and marketing team, anything that works with a customer, including your salary, to be able to get customers, right? And so I'll ask shops this quite a bit. I go like, do you know how many times a year your customer orders from you? And most people are like, maybe a couple times. It's like, you should know that number, because if you know your average order value, that's the average, you know, if you do 100 jobs a year for $100,000, you know that every job's worth $1,000 to you. You should know how many times a customer orders from you on average. It could be 2 times, 3 times, 4 times, whatever. You take, you know, basically see how many times customers order from you and get an average of it. And then you should know your net profit, right? And so the example is, if a customer on average orders from you 3 times a year, and the average customer stays with you for, call it, 5 years, over the lifetime value of that customer, they're going to bring, you know, $15,000 to you, whatever. If your net profit is 10%, you know that that customer is worth $1,500 of profit to you, or on a yearly basis, it's worth $300 a year. Mm-hmm. And so the question you would ask yourself is, how much are you willing to pay to get $300?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, okay, do I want to pay 50%, 20%? What do I want to pay for that? And that's a really low example. Like, I bet you it's a lot higher as shops calculate it. But if you know those three numbers, you have your black box and you can now start to create a model.
So let's say you've got your model built out, it's forecasted, you spend time in stage 2 and stage 3 now with the CFO or fractional CFO. Let's talk about executing. You know, going back to Jan-Feb, what's the next step?
Okay, so we have our black box, we know our accounting. Now we have to recognize that growth is going to cost money. And so you have to go to the well and figure out where you're going to get that money to fuel growth. And what I mean by that is, you're either hiring employees, right? You're hiring a sales team. Maybe you're hiring a sales coach. Maybe you're investing in a marketing agency. Maybe you're hiring marketing people, right? That's what I mean by, you know, growth will cost money. And the interesting thing about the industry is, our industry will spend more money on new presses and everything inside their doors before thinking about sales. Blows my mind, right? They'll invest $100,000 on a press, but not $100,000 in sales, which is just funny. So I think something that we do, and we're very growth-minded, is I'm always investing in sales first, and I'm investing in production last, meaning I will outsource at all costs.
Why do you think that is?
And so because shop owners are not salespeople. They're screen printers, right? And they want to make screen printing easier for them and more efficient. And a lot of shops will say, when I got my first auto, then my business blew up. Well, it's because your job got easier, obviously, and you had more time, but it really should be the opposite. We're really, really fortunate that that happens. So then we realized, okay, what is it going to take to grow? Well, I'm going to need one guy that's going to have to go knock on doors. And that one guy could cost $100,000 a year, let's just call it, after commission and all that stuff. So I look and say, okay, can I afford that? Can I afford $10,000 a month? And how long is it going to take for him to start paying himself off, right? And so that's kind of the same example of if I bought a press and I didn't have any money to feed it, there is a payback period to sales, right? A typical salesperson won't pay themselves off in the first 3 or 4 months, right? And you have to really look at it long tail and say, I'm going to burn money or take out of my profits because I have to ramp this person up, right? Bruce, what about you guys?
I feel like that's the beauty of the sales and marketing hires, though, because they are so measurable. And I do think that when people buy the equipment, whether if they finance it, that lights the fire under them too, because they see the payment and they're like, oh shit, I gotta get this dude, and that really does it. But I think the same, actually, you're right, it applies to the sales and marketing team too. Hey, look, we need X leads coming in. We need Y traffic. We need, Z sales, whatever it is. But you can actually put this into Excel and really map it out. I mean, for the first 12 months of a new sales hire, we said there's a ramp up, like you said, of 4 months, 5 months, 6 months, whatever it is, from zero to their quota goal, their ideal 100% utilization of a quota goal. And maybe they're always at 80% of that goal and then you're happy. But there's a ramp up period. And you can tell by the amount of sales they bring in and the profitability of those sales that you bring in when that person's salary is essentially paid off, and then you're playing with house money afterwards. And that payback period could be 8 months, it could be 12 months, it could be 6 months. But if you have that calculated in, and I honestly would share it with the sales rep, I'd say, look, hey, we built out this goal. This is how you'll be able to ramp up. This is achievable. This is what you can do. Somebody else has done it, or I've done it, or whatever. We're all on the same page. Because the flip side, unfortunately, is not everyone's going to make it in that role in any of the departments. And so now we're able to clearly say, hey, look, like last month was a big miss. Let's talk about this. Why? How do I be able to help you? Okay, second month. Okay, wow. We really miss this again. Is this a good fit? Because if not, maybe we could find another fit here or part ways. Maybe this is just not the right mesh between us two. And then move on and find someone else that can be a good fit. But I love the predictability of creating that roadmap for them, for us to be able to work together so they can achieve it.
Right. And to be clear, I did not do this myself, right? Like, we hired Kevin Baumgart to do it. Kevin's obviously a close friend of ours. Kind of like that fractional CFO that I talked about. We were totally okay. If we were going to grow our business from 5 million to 10 million, it's going to go from 10 to 20. I am totally okay paying a premium for the best sales coach to teach me how to model that out, right? Mm-hmm. And so, like, now I have my numbers. Now I have my sales coach. It's almost like I have a little board around me, is the best way to put it. And I, I have all these crazy ideas, and I don't know if we can execute them or not, but I'll take these ideas to everyone and say, does this model, does this work? Does it jive? Do you think we could do this? And they'll say, go, you can't, watch out for this or this or this, right? And so, if you want to grow your business aggressively, you personally, it's going to be very hard for you to do it consistently if you are the owner. And so one of the big points that I'll make is, I remember hiring my first full-time salesperson, second full-time salesperson. Now we say that a salesperson or an account manager should oversee about $1 million in the business, give or take, right? And so we have a ratio, and we know that our sales team feeds the rest of the company, whether you manage students, whether you manage national accounts on Shopify, whether you manage athletes, there's a certain ratio that we have of, headcount to revenue. And that's another thing that you'll start to tune in. And so that's like a really, really important aspect of the business, is trying to remove yourself from the sales process. You want to be involved, but if you can put a person on it and it's a repeatable task, then it's actually measurable and scalable. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does that make sense?
I was worried, like you said, about the buying equipment versus hiring the sales rep thing. I was scared of hiring the first, you know, one to two salespeople because it's unknown. And you know, it wasn't sure like what was going to happen. I hadn't done it before. So it was just an unknown versus you're right. I'm sure buying the equipment, you see it, you could feel it, you could figure it out. But that's why I personally built out our model for the sales hiring. So I understood first rep, second rep, third rep, and then a lead role on top and what each of those goals are. So that helped clarify. So, okay, great. Now we're rolling along the railroad tracks again. And I feel really good about making this investment because you're right. You do go in the red for a bit until the.
Yeah. And look, the first salesperson, second salesperson, third salesperson is going to be hard to work with, hard to get it right. It's going to be expensive. You're not going to make money for a little bit. But 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 gets easier and easier every single time you hire another salesperson.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? Like it gets easier to grow at the rate that we're at. Because the railroad tracks are so much more like straight and narrow. We know them so much easier. Like we know them so much better.
So how do you feed the sales team? You talked a little bit about marketing. Shops hiring their first salesperson. They're like, okay, where are they getting these leads? Who are they reaching out to? What was your guys' plan last
year? Right. So we're growing different parts of the business. We're growing our Greek part of our business and we're growing our NIL part of our business. So we work with schools. The schools get us the athletes. We build them these huge sites. On the Greek side of the business, we hire students. They sell into fraternities and sororities. And so I looked at it and I said, okay, we have 140 students right now. On average, they do 15, 20 grand a year in sales. For me to double that, I have to hire 130 more students. To hire 130 more students, we're going to have to spend 2 months recruiting, and I'm going to have to pay a recruiting bonus of $50 to $100 per hire, right? And so then we essentially reverse engineer the box a little bit, as I said, and turn it into a game, if you will. So I'll give you an example of a game. Do you know what AOV is, Bruce? AOV?
Average order value?
Average order value. To get your average order value, you take the total sales in a month and divide it by the total amount of orders. So if you do 30 grand in a month and you do 30 orders, your AOV is $1,000 a month, an order. The game that you play with your salespeople is not get to 30 grand. What do you think the game is that I play with the sales team now?
Oh, you're measuring the average order value that you want them to hit?
No, I'm saying just close 35 orders, close 40 orders. Because if they do that, right? If they do that, so hey, last month, just so you know, you closed 30 orders for 30 grand. Your AOV was $1,000. Great job. This month, how do we get to 35 orders? Right? This month, right? Because if they play the game and the AOV stays exactly the same and they get 35 orders this month or 40 orders. So we track sales, but we actually track orders because we have an average.
To mentally track than total sales?
All the time. And what our team does is they'll put a sticky note on their computer and say, okay, I'll just put a checkbox by every order that I get for the month. And based on the averages, I should do this much more if I can just close 40 orders. And so, you know, at Campus Inc., if you ask any of our sales team, hey, what's your AOV? And they'll be like, right now I'm cooking. It's high, but that means it's going to catch up to me. Or they'll say, I've got so many small orders right now. My AOV is low. It's killing me. And they're working on upsells and getting their cart value higher. Right. And so like we've drilled that into everyone's head. It's not about your sales goal. It's about your AOV and the amount of orders you do per month. And so that's a game that we play every single day. And we break it down so much so that we look at how many orders per day a team should be closing.
Wow. That's a little mind-bendy. Just because you're like, whoa, 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 what if the AOV drops?
Then you need to be selling more expensive products. You got to be looking at the cart, right? But really, what creating these trackers will do is increase awareness. And when you increase awareness, your employees will naturally take corrective actions. So Bruce, like, I've told you about this before, the Hawthorne effect.
I remember something.
If someone wants to lose weight, they need to track calories. Because when you track calories, you won't go to the fridge as many times in the day and get crappy food. That's how you lose weight. And so by tracking things and playing these tiny games, your employees and your team will take corrective action naturally because they don't want that to happen anymore. And so I love when the team will come to me and say, dang, my AOV is low right now. Like, and you're like, yeah. But then what's really cool is when they say, my AOV is way higher than the average right now. I'm just waiting for it to just drop, and they're flashy, right? So that's pretty cool when people will track that, and we just keep pushing the needle. And then I'm trying to figure out ways to make them more efficient. So an example of this is, hey, if you're a really good salesperson, you're closing orders, I don't want you to enter in your orders anymore. I want someone else to do it for you. Right. I'm going to hire someone from. So, for instance, an assistant? Yeah. So I'll give you a great example. Jenna on our team, incredible sales individual. She does all of our big corporate sales. She's in Sales Inc. with Kevin, but we'll close $2 million a year. And, you know, she's the face of our local community. Now, what we're working on is we got her an assistant to just enter in orders for her. I was like, Jenna, don't enter in orders yourself. And we hired someone in the Philippines from supportshepherd.com. And all they're going to do is just type in orders, right?
Because, wait, how does that work, right? Because aren't they emailing her about the, or their assistant has access to?
They're CC'd on everything. They're like literally like copied on everything. And I was like, do not waste time punching in orders, because you need to try and get, and you need to talk to more people.
Whoa, wait a second. So let me understand this. So, you know, hey, can I get a quote for this order, but we need these quantities and so on, broken out like this, these different pieces. She'll respond back, absolutely, we'll send that shortly, and CC the assistant types it all up and sends it over. And then she's just focusing on the next. Oh, wow. Okay.
But the idea here is her talent lies in what? Her most valuable asset is her ability to talk to customers and get new customers and drum up business.
True.
Right? By her being an order entry person, we're devaluing like her LeBron James MVP-ness of what she does.
True.
Right? I mean, it's the same thing of why VAs are great. It's the same. It's the GraphX principle. It's the same exact thing. And so this is the first time we're doing it now where I'm challenging Jenna. I'm like, stop entering in your own orders. You're not allowed to enter in orders anymore. Someone else has to do it for you, because I want her to elevate and increase her velocity. And then, you know, if she can talk to 3 or 4 more people a day over the course of a year, that could be another $1 million in sales, right? So that those are the little things that I'm tweaking every single day to try and delegate and elevate.
Okay. So the growth engine has the sales team, it has the marketing team. When you're thinking about adding all these additional sales team members, it makes sense that you can calculate, you know, their growth and everything. Where I'm trying to understand though is, where does the demand come from for them to be able to close deals? Right? You said you've got the Greek side and the NIL side. How did that part work?
So people buy things for four reasons. For a solution to solve a problem, because they feel seen or heard or understood, for logical reasons or for emotional reasons. Those are the four reasons why people buy things, right? For us, we know there is a blue ocean right now. Like this is the wild, wild west. We built a solution that we believe in and that is not present in the market right now. So we are like racing to get this thing out there because we know it works and we believe in it. So like we have a solution. We are out there finding customers that need our solution and getting to their doorstep as quickly as possible, right? But people also buy commoditized things that they could go everywhere else for. And I think that's probably more relevant to today, right? Like, there are so many t-shirt companies out there that people could choose from. And so it's really, really important that there are, you know, strong relationships, but that you also have just an amazing and frictionless experience that makes you slightly more appetizing than going somewhere else. Does that make sense?
Kinda. I mean, you know, for the NIL side, it makes sense. There's a lot of e-com that's going on. There's a lot of marketing you're doing on campuses and stores and all this stuff, which we should get to separately. But the Greek side, those seem to be part of the student-driven organization, if I'm understanding right. And so adding more students then can tap more Greek houses and organizations on campus, and that brings in more sales. I'm assuming that's the
yeah.
rough formula.
Yeah. I mean, we know fraternities and sororities will need shirts. So how do we do that? We hire students in their network to get as close as possible to them.
So how do you handle all the printing and fulfillment for double the amount of sales volume?
We work a lot harder. I always say, we'll figure it out. 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 Sell it. We'll figure it out. Our printing industry is so elastic, so elastic, that we've never not been able to figure it out.
So it's got to be a balance of in-house and contract or other partners.
We are not afraid to sub work out. I think there's this myth that, like, I want to keep everything in-house because of the quality and the speed. There are people out there that are better printers at you that can print for you. I'm first to say we're not the best. We're not amazing printers. When we actually want to do really technical printing, we'll send it to our friends to do, right? And so when I knew that I had a great network of people to help me print, I'm not scared of it at all. And so, like, things that you have to think about are, you know, the different ways that you can sell. I think there's like four or five ways that you can get more customers. You can do reach outs, you can make content, you can run paid ads, or you can get affiliates, right? Those are like the four ways to go get more customers. And so, you know, those are the four things that we do every single day. And we just kind of measure what does better than the other. And then we keep doubling down on what does well.
What about the, was there a point in the year where you guys were behind in the goal? And then what'd you do?
So I actually set the goal at 12 million. We only ended up doing 10, which is still pretty killer. It is my job as the owner of the business to apply the pressure, if that makes sense. Like, I have to bring that pressure needs to be consistent, and I need to know when to turn it up, turn it down, those kind of things. And so we track our goals, like I said, daily, monthly, sometimes hourly. Like, we know, hey, we need to do this much in sales this weekend. And it's the first thing I look at every day. And it's the first thing that I'll try to make adjustments for in real time. And if we're not hitting them, maybe we didn't set the right goals, right? But the goals that we have, everything is attainable. There are railroad tracks. And so I can't get upset with my company for, you know, doing 80% of the goal that I set out the year before to try and take a $5 million company or a $13 million company and landing at 10. I'm still really, really pleased with that, but it's my job to kind of set the big, hairy, audacious goals, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have to be the circus leader and kind of the look like the idiot that wants to do it. Right. Did you ever have to do that, Bruce?
Yeah, I think that's a hard skill, though. I don't think I was good at it. You know,
so you don't pass out flyers to tell your customers that you're going to do it.
Well,
you do it
internally.
Yeah,
that's how I apply pressure for sure to product team. But I think that's because the business kind of emulated me as a person. So I was less on the sales front. I was more on the product front. I think now as a company, we're more balanced. But applying that pressure is difficult, right? Because let's say a sales goal is missed for a month, you know, how do you how would you apply the pressure if sales team was like, okay, hey, look, we missed it. You know, you could be nice about it. You know, is someone getting brought up in an example? Is someone putting on a pip to bring an example? That's the bottom performer. Is, you know, how do you approach that?
Yeah. So one of the best pieces of advice that I got from Kevin, he said, you know, like, your first 3, 4, 6 months of this, your goals are going to change because you have no idea what you're doing. Your commission structure is going to change. You're going to mess things up. You're not going to be as mathematical as you think you're going to be. It's not going to go to plan. So I think the first expectation is when you're going into growth mode, it's setting the expectation with your team that this will change. You don't know what you're doing. You think you know what you're doing, and you're going to be reasonable along the way. But if this is kind of what I say is, you know, if less than half our team is hitting their goal, then our goals are probably set too high. If more than 80% of the team is hitting their goal every month, our goal needs to be higher. And so I'm totally okay knowing that people will not make goal every month. That's totally okay. Because that means that I'm setting it at the right pace. I just need to make sure I have enough people hitting the goals to make sure that it drives up the rest of the team. And so obviously we lean into top performers and we try to make examples out of it. And, you know, you reprimand in private. I don't think you, not reprimand per se, but, you know, if someone is struggling, it's up to you to get in there and make them successful or get them out of your company. Mm-hmm. Right. But yeah, you push the top and pull the bottom, you know, you're pulling them through the mud for sure. I think Bruce, you said something on a couple podcasts, when you're going to hire one salesperson, hire two.
Yeah. So you know how goofy little trick. But has helped us countless times.
Yeah.
It just allows people to be able to, not only for them to compete between each other, but also as the owner, it allows you to see what the baseline actually is. It's very hard to see that when you hire one person because they, you know, you're like, I think they're doing good, right? But they could easily be lapped by someone else and you're like, whoa, the bar's a lot higher than I thought here. So that was definitely helpful.
I think, Bruce, you have to set some crazier goals. Like, you can't be complacent about your goals. If you want to grow with intention and you're willing to invest in it,
yeah,
you have to write it on the whiteboard and be like, yeah, this is crazy. Like, I go back to like people, you know, runners, people that'll get into marathons and they'll have like, my first marathon was 5 hours. I'm going to qualify for Boston and get it down below 3. And yeah, I will have to lose a ton of weight. Yeah, I'm going to have to run for this. Yeah, I'm going to have to get a coach. But like, you have to document it and track your progress. And I just feel like we're like, yeah, if we grow, we grow. That's great. But if you want to grow with intention, it has to be like almost someone that is going to go on an extreme diet or get super healthy or close your rings every day, right? Like, mm-hmm. You have to do that. I think there's a mindset thing to it. What were you going to say? Sorry.
The ups and downs of this. So I think you shared a lot of ups, right? The growth. It's an incredible story. You've got a really strong team now. I've got very strong leadership and you know, had the foundation to continue to push the company forward. What can you share some of the downs? Because I don't know if a lot of people don't talk about the shittier times, especially growth season, let alone just running the business. So now on top of that, you're adding all this acceleration. What are some examples of that?
Well, when you hire more employees, you are in charge of a lot of more human beings and their livelihood. And so when you're growing and growth costs money, you have to sustain that growth because it can be catastrophic. Like my worst nightmare if something takes a turn, right? And so, you know, now we need to be pushing for almost $1.5 million to $2 million a month, right? That's a crazy number. If we have a bad month and we drop to $1 million, but I'm hiring and spending at the same trajectory, I could absolutely sabotage my business overnight. And there's companies that have unfortunately done that, right? And so bigger is not better because it just makes it more volatile. And, you know, if you're not careful, you could realize all of a sudden, oh my God, my payroll is so much. I can't afford to do this. And you can run out of business so fast, like overnight. So that keeps me up at night. Like that is the most stressful thing, is making sure that we will always have a business there through the growth of it. Like that's an uncomfortable feeling that you bear when you're doing something like this. This could all go to shit really quickly. I mean, Bruce, did you ever feel that when you were about to make a big investment, hire a bunch of engineers, like,
mm-hmm.
I don't know.
What's that feeling on the product side? Quite a few times. Because I think what happens is also you start seeing, wow, I see 5 million or 3 million or 1 million or whatever. I see 10 million. I see 20. Like, and the only thing I need to do is, you know, invest in this on the product side or invest in this. And absolutely. That's what, you know, what I found though with myself, anytime I started to get worried about that, it was, I need to break down the model further so I can really understand where I'm at and if I'm behind or if I'm ahead to make me feel more comfortable, because that clears up some of the grayness. But yeah, I mean, you know, a slow week or a slow month, a bad retention month or whatever, it definitely can worry you.
Yeah. And it alters my mood for sure.
You think so?
Like, oh, totally. And I bet you are. Our leadership team will tell you that.
It's like Steven goes a little crazy end of the month.
Well, there's times where I'm on a pogo stick and I'm like jumping around like Buddy the Elf and this is amazing. And like, I'm loving every second of it. And there's some ones where I'm like, let's go. And I'm just grumpier and I push a lot harder. And I'm, you know, when someone wants to buy something or spend something on a new app, I'll be like, no, you know, whatever. So yeah, my mood's definitely, and the decisions I definitely change throughout the month, which that's something I could definitely work on and be more conscious about.
Is it, have you had to part ways with more people just because you've hired more people, you know, like as a percentage of the org, or no? Is most of them
so we're 75
really well.
Probably 75 employees, 15 employees offshore, so I think our team looks like about 90, I want to say. I've fired far and few between or let go, I hire really carefully. I fire fast, but I've been fortunate not to have to do that. We might have, you know, and I think there's kind of two sides of the business, right? You have your sales and marketing team. It's the team that's up in Chicago. You know, these are, and then you kind of have your hourly employees that are actually on the production line. Mm-hmm. We have a really, really good core production line. But we'll add a few employees here and there, and there's some seasonals and stuff like that. But on the full-time side, I, thank goodness, have not had to make too many, haven't had to lay off too many people, maybe a couple a year. Nothing crazy.
So that's really good.
So yeah. Yeah. And we take really good care of them and we pay them really well. They have really, really good benefits. Like it is a fun job. You can see it on our Instagram. We do have a lot of fun at Campus Inc. That also scares me a little bit sometimes. But
ever increasing, you know, budget for doing random stuff with a bigger and bigger team.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything's
I've
bigger.
Seen that well. Okay. Tying it all together, what do you think then are the best lessons learned? So regardless of the number, you know, if it's someone saying, hey, I'm at 750, I want to get to a million. I'm at 100K and I want to get to 300K. I think there's always just the same principles around growth. But for you guys, you specifically, if you were saying, all right, you're going back to Steven and maybe it's June or August or Feb of 2023, what would you have said to yourself then?
I think I would have said, like, know your numbers, dig even deeper to your numbers, and look past your biases and your optimism. You are going to be a very optimistic person. You're always going to think best case scenario, but go back to your data and be super, super data driven in everything that you do. And truthfully, when I've done that, it's kept me both grounded and we've made smarter and calculated decisions in the company. Do I buy another DTF machine? Like before, I'd be like, yeah, sure, let's get this or let's get that. And now it's like, okay, how much more sales are we going to have to do? What's that monthly spend going to look like? What's that headcount going to look like? Are we going to be good in June when we get a dip for the summer? Right. And so I think I would continue to emphasize data driven decisions and knowing your numbers so well. Yeah.
That's cool. All right.
What about, yeah. What I'm curious for you, you've seen us go through these inflection points and you've also seen me go off the deep end and do some crazy things like pop-up shops and
yeah,
invent new things. And, you know, I text you and Kevin all the time and you're a good, you always can play the devil's advocate and kind of keep me grounded and be like, okay, yes, all right, whatever. Like, are you sure about that? What have you seen from afar looking in? I mean, you're in our Slack and we talk a bunch, but what have you noticed from kind of looking at it from afar?
Maybe
it's what have you noticed about me? I'm curious.
I think the good thing is that you'll be very curious about poking around to pick up and learn different stuff. Obviously, growing a business to this size at this speed requires definitely a different skill set. So you're playing hard mode there, right? But you've got a really curious mindset, which is allows it to be able to figure things out. I do think then the second thing is that also you're playing on hard mode times two because new market, right? I mean, we were talking the other day, NIL hasn't been a thing 2 years ago. It started 3 years ago. So it's super recent. So no one has proven it out. And then you're kind of rolling in their coattails, right? So you're figuring it out and you're executing on it on the same time. So that makes it very difficult. I think the one thing that I've seen here at Inktavo that you guys are getting to, but is just the, especially at the 10 million mark, the level of person can, and maybe you have this, but it's very hard to get stuck in doing too many things as well. And as a person, I think as an owner, it's like, getting sucked into the weeds and then getting pulled out. And I like watching some of our team now where it's, where they set the goals and they kind of let it happen. And I do wonder is to what's the balance of it, right? Sometimes it is like, no. Like, why does it look like that? And other times it's like, should I just let them make it look like that and make sure that they hit the goal? Cause if they hit the goal, then I don't really care how it is. I'm kind of speaking in abstract here a little bit, but does that make sense or no?
It's how
deep? It's like where Bezos talks about, I got to go 1,000 feet and then I can go up to 35,000 feet. But then he talks about over time, he goes 35 to 10,000 feet or so. He's not going all the way down to one. And so where is that transition? And I'm not exactly sure, but it feels like it's now-ish, right? Where you've got the fleshed out management for each of the departments, you're thinking about all the numbers, you got the CFO, you're trying to run around, you're trying to pull all the knobs and everything. And do you get in the weeds and does that make you stressed out or do you feel like you still have to be? And I'm not sure.
I do not have to get in the weeds. I get in the weeds on purpose sometimes. There's times where I get in the weeds because I want to get in the weeds, and there's times where I get in the weeds when I shouldn't get in the weeds. We have our office in Chicago, we have our facility down in Urbana. I could be one of the most remote employees at Campus Inc., meaning I go into our production facility for one day a week to be present, to spend time with them, to have meetings with my production manager and a couple key employees there, but I remove myself right away because I know the longer I stay there, the more I'm going to have my hand in something that I do not need to be touching. Mm. Like, I do not need to be messing with that. Now, we also have 150 Slack channels of all the different teams running, and I'm in a lot of them. Most of them are muted, but I'm watching a lot of them. There's one yesterday that they added me to of emails going out to different schools, and they're figuring out some new things there. And I was like, you know, I'm just not going to say anything, but I really wanted to, but I was like, this is their space. I just need to put that on mute. And then there's things that I really like to get myself into. And maybe this is where I say, like, I'm improvising, or I'm working on new parts of the business, or I'm making a mess in the kitchen. And when I do that, it's costly, and I do it alone so that I don't impact other people, right? And so, like, I am, you know, if I'm inventing, I'm usually alone so that I don't mess up anyone else's MO and what they're doing, because that could be a huge distraction. So I almost, like, I work pretty independently, but I kind of have my eye on things and can fly in on if I need to. But I try to stay more and more distant from the day-to-day every day. So I don't get in the way because I slow things down. I don't know.
Psychologically, it's very difficult, though. It's easy in practice or in theory to say it, but yeah.
Yeah.
In reality.
And look, there's some stuff. And look, there's some things that you will nerd out about as the owner of your business. Don't stop nerding out about that. I nerd out about DTF prints. Like, I'm obsessing about it, right? I'm nerding out about some things in sublimation. And so that is my, like, special, some superpowers. So I am going to keep doing those. And that's totally okay too, right? I don't think it's like I have to completely be out of those things. If they're fun, you should do them. So, yeah.
All right. That was good.
Hope everyone enjoyed it. If you ever have any questions, hit me up. We'll have to do this again in a year and see if we got to our goal.
Yeah. The next year's goal. We'll do a recap in a year. I'll mark it on the calendar. Hey, pronouncers.
Oh boy.
Appreciate you guys joining us for another episode. Hopefully you enjoyed it. Drop a comment, like, subscribe, the bell thing. If you did, we always like that too. We'll see you guys in the next episode, though. Thank you. Thanks so much for listening. Hopefully that was informative. Don't forget to subscribe. Don't forget to like. Don't forget to hit the bell for notifications if you enjoyed this video. If you enjoy all the stuff we're putting out, it's really helpful. We love to just be able to see it. That means that we're doing a good job. To subscribe, hit the bell for notifications, and hit the like button. And I'll see you in the next episode. Bye.